Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to MRG Studios here today. This is the G-Man. Folks, we got a really great afternoon planned out for you here. We have a first part of an eight-part series that we were gracious enough to given the authorization from Mr. Bill Blair. As you know, Bill Blair Jr. is the son of legendary stock car driver, NASCAR legend Bill Blair, and Bill does a lot of interviews and does a lot of filming work on his own, bringing back the stock car history. As you know, we're doing a very large presentation on the preservation and the reservation of stock cars and history and the legends and the icons from the series. And Bill Blair has put together a very good selection of audio tapes and recordings that he'd done with various drivers, engine builders, and we're going to play one today. Today is the first of an eight-part series. Today's series recognizes a legend and a real icon, and I'm talking about an icon in stock car racing, Mr. Rex White. All these recordings and all these presentations here are produced and authorized by Bill Blair for the MRG Studios for us to do playback on. And we want to express a very sincere thank you to Bill Blair and all the associates connected with Bill for allowing MRG Radio here to be a part of the rebroadcasting. They're short segments, some run 30 minutes, some about 18 minutes. Some of the segments will be upwards of an hour. But we're just very honored and very pleased for Bill to allow us here at MRG to play back some of these historic commentaries, interviews that he's had. So sit back, enjoy, and remember, folks, tomorrow night, Wednesday night show, be right here. I'm sorry, Wednesday night show, not Tuesday, Wednesday night show. We have a very special show lined up for you, and Thursday night will be part two with Bill Blair and Gary Llewellyn live here in the studios. So enjoy, and we'll see y'all in a couple of days right back here in the studio with part two from the legendary Bill Blair and Gary Llewellyn, and we'll talk more about racing. We'll pick up from the first episode that we did last week there, and part three, just so you know, part three will actually be done on location from up there at Bill Blair's race shop, so that should be a great, very interesting episode here in the four-part documentary. So, folks, once again, thank you to Bill Blair and all the associates for allowing us to be a part of the playback. Hope you enjoyed today's presentation, and we'll catch all of you all on Wednesday night show. This is the G-Man here at the MRG Studios saying enjoy, have a great day, God bless y'all. Thank you again, Bill Blair. Folks, we'll see you on Wednesday night. Presentation again, we're ready to go. Here we go, green flag and up and rolling.
Rex White.
Good evening, thanks. Bill.
Well, thank you so much for coming over.
My pleasure.
I'm honored that you're back here to see me again.
And thanks for the lunch.
It was great, wasn't it?
It sure was.
Anytime. It's on me, partner. Well, look, I've been looking at your book, reading it, and probably one of the best stock car racing books about the early days and the way guys really were. It's truthful. It's honest. And I've enjoyed reading it. Probably one of the better books I've ever read on early day stock car racing. It's your autobiography, and I want you to know I enjoyed it. Appreciate you signing that book, number four, Rex White, 2005 for Bill. But I certainly enjoyed it. What really struck me in this book was your early days, how you started out working on the farm. Your daddy was really a strict guy. I mean, he really was. He's hard on you, wasn't he?
You bet.
Tell me just, you know now what you got out of those early days that was instilled in you forever, all the rest of your life. Can you reflect back on those days just a minute for us?
Well, it was tough back then. You had to stay to make a living and make clothes and do the things you had to. You had to work hard at it. There wasn't no time for play. Cows want to eat three times a day. Horses, so do the people.
What time did you get up in the mornings?
Well, usually I didn't get up probably until sometime around 5 in my early days. But a lot of times I went to the barn with them to milk cows mm-hmm. And do the chores in the barn.
Okay, is this a dairy farm? Or is this
we sold milk to Carnation Milk Company, and we needed to milk from 10 to 15 cows every day in order to meet our quota.
Mm-hmm. And I read in the book where you used to listen to those 39-44s at night and early in the morning coming. What did that feel like? That send chills up and down your arms?
Well, I was familiar with the Ford dealer in Taylorsville, and I seen them adding a two-bore carburetor. Some had three, some had two, and like that. The Elderbrock heads, Offenauer heads. And my brother actually worked for the Ford dealer, and so I was familiar with those cars, and I liked that sound. I also liked to go fast.
Mm-hmm. When did you start to drive and then get a hold of one of these cars?
Well, you know, I never drove a car but one time with a high-powered engine, and we was going to Charlotte, North Carolina to get a load of whiskey, tax-paid whiskey, not bootleg. And I was around 10 years old, and the guys he's passed away, so I go ahead and name his name, Bryce Little. He let me drive about halfway to Charlotte, and I didn't even have a driver's license. And that was my first time to feel the power of a powerful engine and in a 40 Ford coupe. We got 25 cases of whiskey and headed back to Taylorsville.
Now, did you have driver's license
no.
then? Okay,
no.
How old were you?
No, I wasn't. I was somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years old.
When you said multi-carburetors, well, I got two. This is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you saw that in early age. And
oh, yeah.
Did you ever think about, at that time, did you realize one day that's what you wanted to do? With
Not at that time. I really didn't. At that time, I didn't even know about stock car racing yet. The first thing I knew about stock car racing was like the sign you got up there on the wall says Shelby Racing, mm-hmm. Stock car racing, Shelby Fairgrounds and stuff like that. But that was at North Wilkesboro, but I never got to go there, and then left Taylorsville and wound up going to my first race in Lanham, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. When you went to your first race and saw the race take place, did that grab you? Is that something at that time you knew that's what you wanted to do? Or
well, let me put
feel?
It this way. I went there and saved my money to go to this. I'd been looking at that sign in the window for maybe a couple months. It was close to the end of the season in 1951. And so finally got enough money and decided to go to the race. And my brother-in-law was with me and his wife and my wife. The first stock car I ever seen come out and go around the racetrack, this racetrack, you couldn't see the cars the way the pit area was made up. The first car come out and made a lap even slow. And then he speeded up. And I told my wife, I said, that's what I want to do. Immediately,
that's what you wanted to do.
That's what I wanted to do.
And did you get to go down the pits and mingle with the drivers?
Not at that time. Didn't really go in the pits until the next season opened up. Mm-hmm. And they had boards running straight up and down. And I took a board off and slipped in the pits because you had to buy a NASCAR license and pay $2 to get in the pits. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have that. So anyway, I got in the pits where I could get around the cars. And I liked the number 88, Frankie Schneider. Mm-hmm. And it was a color that I liked. And got to hang it around, help change the axles, help change tires, put the tow bar on the tow back out of there and all that. And got to be friends with him.
You
and it the boy that was working for him got drafted in the Army. And he asked me, he said, you want to go racing? I said, yeah.
And that was his car? And
that was he was driving for John Bolander, which is his car owner.
And that's 1951.
That was
1952. 52. Well, looking back at it now, and all these guys that you met back in those days, and I heard you talk, and a lot of them are still your friends today, and I guess you, much like I am, they were my heroes, and I know that you look up to Frankie Schneider because he was your mentor.
Definitely.
It's a different deal then, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Entirely different, I think. Some of the things is kind of like back in those days, but it was, you know, you could go and get in the pits and pal around with a lot of people, and most all race cars had followers or got free help. And of course, I didn't get paid anything from Frankie. I bought me something to eat, and that's all. But it's sure changed now.
Yeah. And you looking, you know what racing is today, and back in the 60s, but back in the 50s, and the big picture for you was you knew that's what you wanted to do. And so you started your career, and it progressed, and then it required help, sponsorship, and then what happened?
Well, I worked for Frankie, and of course I wasn't making any money at Hartford. I had a wife, and so I met a guy that had a pinball machine and jukebox route, and he helped me put together a race car, sponsored me money-wise, mm-hmm. and we started out. He had a race car before, and anyway, I flipped it, wrecked it, and we built a new car, and then finally I built a car. I built my own engine, the first race I ever won. I didn't do the porting or leaving to it, but I did all the assembly of the engine and won a race with it. I built the whole car, every bit of it. Roll bars, bumpers, everything.
Was that the first race you won?
That was the first race
I won. You still remember that?
Never will forget it. It has to be a big thing for your first win. Mm-hmm. Even got a trophy. I still got pictures of it that night. Because normally you didn't get a trophy.
How much money did you win?
I think it was about $260, which this racetrack paid pretty good. It was over $200 I won that night.
That's big money.
You bet.
Then. That would be equivalent to, what, $10,000, $15,000 today almost?
Well,
probably
maybe,
not, but $5,000, $6,000 anyway,
yeah.
Wouldn't it?
It was big just to win if I didn't get any money.
Well, did your parents get to see you win?
No, my parents never went to a racetrack at all, ever.
Was your dad still living when you won your first race?
No. No, he was passed away.
He had no idea what you were going to do?
No, I don't. He was almost helpless for 10 years of his life with Parkinson's disease, and he didn't know anything about it. But I took all my trophies for years to my house at home in Taylorsville, and my mother used to really enjoy showing people all my trophies and stuff.
When you won your first race, and I asked you, was your parents alive and get to enjoy the first win? Which they weren't, and that's a shame. I know that they'd have been proud of you. But in reading the book, I sensed that probably your dad never visioned that you'd drive a race car and probably would not have approved of it.
No way, because it would have took me away from the farm.
And farming was his thing. He was a dedicated farmer, and from the book, I gather that he taught you an awful lot that you still got with you to this day.
Well, he taught me to not give up and do things in the best way I could and work hard. The whole secret is how much you try at it, whether it's racing or anything else.
And never say I can't.
That's right. Not use that word at all.
So if he were here today, I know you'd get up and embrace him and shake his hand and say, thank you, Father.
You bet.
Well, parents back then, a lot of them were like that.
He taught me the basic things that you need to be successful in this country.
Wouldn't you say a lot of the racers back then had a similar life? I mean, you know, the 32 Ford, that was the first V8, and then we'd get faster and faster with more horsepower, the 85 horse and then the 100 horse, and you came in at about not at the very, very beginning, but you came in when it was the foundation had been laid, but still you had the family ties to it, and you had the group or community. All the guys were friends and helped one another, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Frankie Snyder come from a background almost like mine, but a very much smaller farmer, but he was a farmer also, and that's all he ever done.
Right. Well, you know, I grew up on a farm. And that's the way my daddy got started. And you probably ran a few races with my dad when he was on his way out. You probably remember him.
Probably run with him on the beach.
Yeah.
The first race I run at the beach was 54.
He was at Langhorne when you raced up there in 56, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think he finished, and you both finished in the top 10. He was driving Pascal's car, Jim Pascal's car.
I was driving a Chevrolet for Max Welburn. And Donald Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Well, give me a picture of what you thought of the guys back then. Just how did they feel about stock car racing? specifically, do you think that they ever envisioned that racing and NASCAR would turn out what it is today?
You know, Bill, I don't really think that any of us back then, not even including Bill France, envisioned it being as big as it is today. I don't believe anybody had that most forethought, actually. But I don't think they knew where it might wind up.
And the way I remember, and you tell me how you feel, if you needed to talk to management, meaning Bill France, you could talk to him. Could
all you had to do is have a phone or drive up in his office or home or wherever and talk to him.
Didn't need an appointment.
You didn't need no appointment.
Nope.
What
a difference a day makes, huh? And then you raced for a year driving for Max Welborn, and then you left for a period of time, then you came back. Tell me about that period of time, what transpired.
Well, in 1954, I never won a race in 1954, but I was running good. Yeah, I'd already won races at Millennium. I take that back. But anyway, at Bowling Gray Stadium, they got more publicity in the magazines and the racing magazines and all that than anybody. Billy, Bobby Myers, Pee Wee Jones, Glenn Wood, Curtis Turner, all those people. And anyway, I set out to go to Bowman Gray Stadium in 1955 and run the whole season. Well, on the way to Bowman Gray Stadium, I was coming down Highway 29, and here was a sign that said Stock Car Racing tonight at Schrader Field in Lynchburg, Virginia. So I told Sonny, I said, let's just stop and see if we can get in. Anyway, we stopped, went in. Nobody questioned, bought a pit pass, went in. So help me, I won the race. And anyway, when we went out to warm up, I was used to, my car handled good. And Billy Myers, I said, well, I'm going to follow Billy. So he went in the corner and he stopped. Well, I knocked hell out of him.
Oh, Lord.
And I figured that was going to cause a problem. As soon as I got back in the pits, here he come. And I said, boy, I don't know what's going to happen now. He said, boy, I'm sorry. He said, I didn't. He said, I'd like to look at your car. Well, anyway, he and I become friends. He invited me to a shop. I stayed in his garage all that summer and actually slept and worked out of his shop. Become great friends with him and Bobby and Billy.
One of the deals, you could just go through the corner so much faster.
Yeah.
Now, you're known to be a good chassis man, and you brought a lot of stuff to stock car racing, the Watts linkage and different things and starting of the tuning of the shocks. But you're well known for that, and you still have that knowledge today, and I enjoy talking to you about chassis. You're a gifted person, but you self-taught yourself a lot, didn't you?
Well, making the car go through the corner fast, and that helps you get down the straightaway, and you don't have to buy all that horsepower. That's cheaper to make the car handle than it is to buy a big engine so you can just fly down the right straightaway and stop in the corner.
And Billy, when he wanted to look at your car, he was looking at that chassis.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to find
I showed him how much wedge I had in the car and everything.
Mm-hmm. And did you come on down to the stadium?
I come to the stadium, run all season, won two more races that year at Lynchburg. And I never did beat Billy Graham. He won about all the races there that year. I mean, he was really tough. I did run second one time to Billy at Bowman Gray Stadium. He had a more powerful engine. Matter of fact, he helped talk me into changing to Arnold Charles cam,
right,
a fish carburetor, and redo my engine, and it really helped. But I wasn't able to win a race at Bowman Gray Stadium. That's it right there.
A fish carburetor. They're pretty scarce today.
Very simple and a good engine, a good carburetor for engines.
And at Bowman Gray, were you running two carburetors or just one?
No, we were running Sportsman. You only could run one carburetor.
Okay. So you ran probably with Curtis Turner and some of those guys.
I ran with Curtis a lot. Glenn Wood was a regular all time. He was somebody you had to beat, that's for sure.
You know the same families are still going, sitting in the same seats as they did 50 years ago?
Yeah.
So when did you start getting into Grand National?
Well, I run Bowman Gray all that season, and I went to Florida that winter to run the circuit down there. And Alvin Hawkins, naturally I knew him because he was a promoter, and he called me up and said that Pioneer Chevrolet was looking for a driver to drive a new car at Daytona. He said, "Do you want to drive it?" And I said, "Sure." So anyway, we got together, and they brought the car to Daytona. And the biggest thing they'd done was they put a roll bar in it, they put a seat belt in it, and they took the hubcaps off. And we actually ran the tires that come on that car from General Motors in the, on the beach at Daytona.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't continue to race continuously in NASCAR until 1960?
No, I continued to run Grand National from that day on. I run all of 56.
Okay.
And at the end of the year in 1956, the car was pretty beat up and needed some work on it. So I took a couple weeks off, worked on the chassis, worked on new sway bar mounts and stuff, and went to Detroit, which was Flat Rock Speedway. And, well, that was before Murray Rose and Chevrolet, and I sat on the pole up there, beat Jim Reed for the pole and everything. Led the race, run over a big hub. A guy lost a hub spindle and everything in the middle of the racetrack. I destroyed the car. And anyway, I got recognition from Chevrolet and got invited to Detroit to be hired to be a Chevrolet driver for 1957. So that set my career.
And Hugh Babb was the head man.
Hugh Babb was a supervisor of the... Frankie Delroy was the head of the whole thing, but Hugh was the next man under him.
And that was in 57. Then you fast forward to 1960.
Well, 58, I won some races in 58 and 57 Chevrolet. Mm-hmm. I won three in 57 in the factory car.
And then Baker and Thompson, Steve Thompson,
yeah.
And Jack Smith and Welburn and Slick, the guy that drove Webb, Possum Jones.
Possum Jones, yeah.
And there was a good group of guys in Chevrolet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Buck, Speedy, Jack Smith,
Jim Reed,
Possum Jones, Bob Welburn.
And that's the 57 year they brought the convertibles on, or 56?
No, the convertibles was running in 55.
55, okay.
I believe it started in 55.
Okay,
and Welburn had two championships.
Yeah, so it's basically Welburn and Possum in the convertibles.
Right.
Y'all did the Grand National stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then that led up to your championship year, 1960. Can you tell us about how tough that was? You had to run an awful lot of races and work day and night.
Not too many. I only run 54.
Oh, Lord. And how many people do you have helping you?
Well, at that time, it was really three of us. James Hilton, Louie, and myself. But now we did have a lot of free help that come by and work at night and stuff like that. You don't win a championship with one or two people or just a driver. It has to be a group.
And how
it's
many
a
cars?
Team. One car.
One car.
Yeah. No, I take that back. I did have two cars in 60.
It was a wonderful road to 1960 and a championship. A lot of recognition, a lot of friends. And then let's go to 61, 2, and 3.
Well, back up to 60.
Okay.
I don't know how many days we got to be on this thing, but in 1959, I was broke. So anyway, I had a new 60 Chevrolet, but no money to build it with. Well, Monroe Shook from Keysville, Virginia, wanted me to build a car for Emanuel Cervakas. So anyway, he said, "I'll give you $2,000 to build a car." Well, I built him a car just like mine. Both cars just alike, and the $2,000 that I got from him, I built my car and went to Daytona on and lived out of that money.
With $2,000.
And
you know what it would take today to do what you did in 1960?
Millions.
Probably about $30 million, and they would have to run that many races. They'd probably have a couple hundred people working on that car and probably have a fleet of cars.
How the two cars come about in 1960 is kind of a cute story in a way. Jim Rathman wanted me to sell my 59 to a guy in Lima, Peru, and go over there and drive it, or go over there and supervise it and put a driver from over there. So I agreed, got the car all ready, changed it over to a road course setup. Mario Rossi, and I'm sure everybody listening to this knew who he was. So he was hanging around. He was broke, didn't have a job, and he was hanging around my shop. And I said, "You want to go to New Orleans with me and help drive?" He said, yes. So anyway, we started in New Orleans in Demopolis, Alabama. I decided to let him drive some. Well, he went about 10 miles down the road and went off in a bunch of trees down a big bank, wrecked the pickup truck and the race car both. So finally got them out, got it out, and got it to a gas station in Cuba, Mississippi. So I didn't know what to do. So G.C. Spencer had a 59 Chevrolet, so everything would fit, you know, without doing a lot of modifications. So I bought his 59. He brought it down there, and we switched all my stuff into his car. So we got it all done. This is about 2 weeks or a week and a half before the plane was supposed to be there. So many days, I forget now. Anyway, we got it all ready to go, and I called Louis to tell him I was going to head on to New Orleans to be ready to put it on the boat. The guy come from Lima, Peru on an Eastern Airlines, and it crashed into Lake Pontchartrain and killed him and everybody on board. Well, naturally, that undid everything. So I took the car back home, switched, give GC back his car, put my car all back together, and I'm sitting here with two race cars. So I had to have a car to run on dirt and one to run on pavement. And with that, we started running and started getting up in the points, and that's how it all come about.
Well, you whipped them pretty bad that year.
Well, I won by a lot of points, but that was the reason why that happened was at Charlotte was a new racetrack, and you weren't supposed to cut across the median to come into pits if you blew a tire after you went by pit road. Well, Lee and Richard, they run blow tires and cut across and went in the pits, and they took all their points away.
I see.
And that's how I wound up with so many in the lead.
Well, and that was 1960, and I think you won by 4,000 points, if I remember. And then in 61, the 409, you had a 409 Chevy then?
No,
348.
348 in 61.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that engine compared to the 409 and 427, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I probably ought not to say this, but the 348 and the 409, the biggest thing they was good for was boat anchors.
Okay.
the combustion chamber in that Chevrolet was not good for 500-mile racing.
It was down in the cylinder,
in
wasn't
the cylinder wall.
And the head was flat, basically.
Flat, yeah. And it just wasn't a good design. It was designed for a truck engine, is what it was.
Well, was that not the truck engine?
That was the truck engine, yes.
And it's almost akin to a flathead Ford in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Just about. But then the 427s, though, but you ran pretty good those 348s and
49s. Well, on the short racetracks and places like that, but the races I won, most all of them was the chassis won me the race, not the engine.
I remember the story about you fixing the shocks with beer can material.
Nope, you're wrong.
Okay, what you
think? It was a Coca-Cola can.
Coca-Cola can. Same difference. You just didn't drink beer, did you?
Well, you couldn't open the shocks up and work on them back in those days. And we put it on a bandsaw and opened the shock up and took it apart. And then I brazed it up when I put it back together, and I put STP in it for fluid.
Well, now, how did you put the fluid in it and keep it in there while you welded it?
I drilled a plug and put a pipe tap in it and put a screw in it and closed it up.
Okay. You didn't tell NASCAR?
Well, they didn't know. That
they didn't ask,
they didn't inspect things back then like that. You could
now.
Do anything you wanted with a shock. Mm-hmm. But, see, I'd done a bunch of tire testing in Atlanta, run a lot of laps there for Firestone and Goodyear both. And that bump going into one, if you went around it, it hurt your lap time. If you went over it, hurt your lap time. So the biggest thing we did in 1962 down there was make that shock so I could go over that bump. And I didn't even know when I went over it. And it really made a difference.
Didn't upset the car and just cruise right
over it. You just go right over it.
Well, so much talk about the mystery 427 engine and then Chevrolet pulling out. And things begin to change for you just a little bit. Sort of expand on that and tell us what happened.
Well, the 427 project got started awful late and got behind, and they never built any passenger cars and sold that engine in a Chevrolet race car before Daytona. And General Motors was afraid of getting broke up separating Chevrolet from Pontiac, Pontiac from Buick, and Cadillac, and breaking them all up, and they were so afraid of it. Bucky Knudsen was the president of Chevrolet, and he probably thought he could get away with doing this. And so I had a great contract that year. The only time I'd ever had a contract with Chevrolet, and I was really so enthused with the 427 when we got to the proving grounds in Arizona and tested it, and it was pulling big horsepower. And we got to Daytona a week before the race down there. The Chevrolet come on and said, "We're out of racing business. We're gone again." And that had happened to me in 1957 the same way. In June, they just fired us all, and boom, they're gone. But it was a big disappointment to lose I didn't lose the sponsorship. Chevrolet paid me for the agreement that I had with them, and but I didn't have we didn't have any valve cover gaskets, no head gaskets. We used head gaskets over and over again, and ran it up until June, and then I went with Mercury.
Yeah, Bill Strop.
Bill Strop, yeah. And he gave me a car all built, ready to go.
Well, the Mercury's drove a good bit different, probably.
Totally. And I had got used to coil springs, had to go back to leaf springs, and it was a big adjustment for me to make the car handle good.
I know that you probably don't look at that point in time. I think you said, "I'm just not going to look back. I'm going to move on." But you had to put a lot of thought into it. What would have happened had I stayed in racing? And that's a hard call to make. I know you have no regrets about your career. It's a wonderful career, really. You know, you're our hero. And NASCAR 1960 champion, now going to be in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Racing's been good to you, and you've been good to racing. And like many others, like Fonnie Flock and Richard Petty, you've been a great ambassador to stock car racing. And we're really honored to have you here and for you to be, and congratulations about being in the NASCAR Hall of Fame next year. I want to thank you for...
Bill, it's good to just be here shooting the bull with you.
Rex, before we end this, I want to read a forward in your Gold Thunder book about what Rick Minner had to say in his farewell column in the Atlanta Journal. And the reason I want to read this, it really describes you, I think. The great sports editor, Ed Danforth, wrote about a lesson his father had taught him years before. He said his father told him that when courting the young ladies, it was best to pick a time when you're both laughing, then get your hat and leave. Those words, written decades ago, are still good advice for young suitors, for newspaper writers, and for race drivers. Rex White, who may or may not have read Mr. Danforth, was at the top of the sport when he pulled off the track for his final time, an exit that came while he and his fans were still smiling about his on-track accomplishments, which were many, a championship and won 20-some races, I believe. 28 races. Sure, he was a bit peeved at NASCAR and General Motors for the lack of support, and there may have been other reasons, but nevertheless, Rex drove off into the sunset before his time came, when he could have won more races, and it wasn't that he couldn't win anymore. Before, he needed special favors like past champions provisionals just to get into the races. In other words, you were still at the top of your game and a real competitor, as good as he came. The way he performed in his era, the way he left the sport, and the way he was able to build another life outside of racing makes him forever a winner, forever a champion, forever a hero. Rick Minner. Friend, you are our hero.
Thank you, Bill.
An old four running on a red dirt road. The stars are bright and the moon is low. Revenue man coming up behind. Bet he thinks he's gonna catch me with this load of moonshine. But I cut the lights and mask the gas, turn a curve into a straight line. You're gonna play this game with me, you got to know how to drive. If you lose on Sunday, you just lose a race. But when you're driving with the devil, boy, ain't no second place.